Shrink Wrap Radio number 480, Why Psychotherapy Works with Dr. Louis Cozzolino.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my return guest is Dr. Louis Cozzolino, psychologist, professor, and among others, author of the 2015 book, Why Therapy Works, Using Our Minds to Change Our Brains. For more information about Dr. Louis Cozzolino, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is audible.com. who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Dr. Lou Cozzolino, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Good to be here, David.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you back here, and such exciting times we live in terms of everything that neuroscience has been revealing, and you have been one of the primary documentarians, so I'm glad to have you back. We spoke back in 2013 about your book on the neuroscience of psychotherapy. Now you've got a new book out, which is titled Why Therapy Works, Using Our Minds to Change Our Brains. It sounds like it could potentially be a little redundant of the earlier book. What does this new book add to the picture?
Well, I think two things that come to mind is, the first is that what I've tried to do in Why Therapy Works is to consolidate and focus more like a laser beam the core principles that, you know, have emerged from the other books that I've been writing. I don't talk so much in depth about the science in this book. This is more a book for people that want sort of the, you know, more of the condensed focus version, like the cliff notes of everything else that I've done.
Yeah.
And I've tried to make it as applicable to psychotherapy as possible, assuming that people by now already have sort of a surface understanding of the science.
Yeah, and I think it really succeeds at that. So who's this book for? Is it a book primarily for clients or therapists or the general public? Who did you have in mind?
Well, I mean, I think that I think compared to previous books, especially the, you know, the science heavy books, for me, this book was written for the general audience. And, you know, I think that therapists certainly would be able to benefit from it, but the general public, people that are interested in therapy, I think one of the challenges for clients is that, you know, there are thousands of different forms of therapies with different sets of initials, and more come out every week. And it's difficult for clients to know how to choose. And so they rely on recommendations of friends or whatever, which makes sense because you want to get connected with someone who is a good person to work with, who's, you know, who has integrity and all of that. But I think that what gets lost in the sauce of the 10,000 therapies is what the core elements are in all therapies that make them either successful or unsuccessful. So that's really what I've tried to focus on here is what's the bottom line?
I've been of the opinion that maybe we've gone from 10,000 to 9,000 or maybe even 6,000 because of the a core understanding of neuroscience and what works. So I really think there's more of a consensus that's beginning to develop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're getting to the core elements of what are the levers of change. And mm-hmm. I think that's really what I focused on in this book.
Yeah.
Of course, the two primary ones, you know, one is the centrality of relationships and the power of relationships mm-hmm. to regulate, you know, emotion and for the creation of new learning. And the other piece is the science of neuroplasticity. In other words, what are the actual underlying mechanisms of action that allowed the psychotherapeutic relationship to result in change?
Yeah, well, before we get into that, why do people need therapy in the first place? Are there any generalizations we can make about why human beings need therapy?
Well, I don't know. It's not really a generalization. It's pretty broad, but we can get a few points from it. I think is that it's evolution's fault. I blame evolution.
Okay.
What evolution has done is has created, you know, evolution adapts to situations and we adapt. And there's selective, you know, natural selection and all of that. So we adapt to the environmental changes, both physical environment and the social environment. And humans, at least, have developed these incredibly large, complex brains that are problematic. It's kind of like if you've ever, you know, if you've driven a Subaru for years and you buy a Ferrari, you're overwhelmed by the amount of maintenance and attention to details and problems that occur in a Ferrari. And it's the same thing with us. I mean, we've got brains that really are like Ferraris, and there's a lot of things that can go wrong now. And I think that's why therapists have so much job security, is that so many things do go wrong. And so I blame evolution.
Okay. One of the things that you mentioned in relation to this that fits with what you're saying about the brain is what you call the vital half second. What are you getting at there?
Well, there's, you know, the parts of our neural functioning and our, you know, our brain work that we share with other animals, we still have. And a lot of our, you know, moment-to-moment existence is still run by these very primitive networks of the brain stem and the, you know, the limbic system, all of the mechanisms below the cortex. And that's why we can drive and listen to music and talk on the phone and do our nails and all of that stuff simultaneously, because a lot of that stuff gets on automatic pilot, as does respiration and, you know, reflex activity and all of that. Consciousness is a very complicated achievement, and it takes many, many more neural connections and a lot more neural processing. It goes very fast still, but it takes about a half a second for us to be conscious of our experience. And so the vital half second is between the almost immediate reaction of our primitive brain and the 500 milliseconds it takes for us to have conscious awareness. And within that half a second, all of our history shapes our experience in ways that are both good and bad, depending on how good a match our past experience is with the present.
Yeah, you know, one of the hats I wear is that of a market research consultant. And so the work of a fellow psychologist, Kahneman, about fast thinking and slow thinking, and marketers are just seizing upon that for marketing advantage.
Yeah. Well, Marshall McLuhan wrote about this in the 50s and 60s, you know, about subliminal suggestion. The reason why we have subliminal suggestion is because our you know, unconscious processes are reacting by 50 milliseconds. So you can insert pictures of, you know, of salient images like sexual or financial things so quickly in an advertisement that the viewers they're not even aware that they've seen it, and yet they'll be more attracted to a product that's connected with sexual excitement or with financial remuneration.
Yeah, even without subliminal insertion of things like that, there's this whole field that's developed around the process of decision making, and how so much of our decision making happens, I guess, well, is at least influenced by subcortical processes that we're not aware of. Just as our psychopathology is influenced by subcortical processes that we're not aware of.
Right. You know, I think Antonio Damasio woke neuroscience up to this in the mid 1990s with Descartes' error. And, you know, showing the relationship between the somatosensory cortices and decision making, and how much of it is driven by intuition or ability to pull the trigger on decisions. Mm-hmm. And of course, advertisers have known this for a long time. People, social psychologists have known this for a long time as well. Neuroscience was a little late to that party.
Now, you introduced a term I've not heard before, which is the social synapse. What is the social synapse, and what's its role, and why therapy works?
Well, I think just as background to that, I think that I've learned so much, and I think others have as well. We learn so much by observing the behaviors of other animals, because we don't have skin in their game. You know, we don't have all sorts of ego tied up in it. So we can see what, by watching other animals, we can see how our behavior is similar and get a new window to our own, you know, our own day-to-day functioning. I think in the same way, I've learned so much about human behavior and psychotherapy by studying how neurons interact with each other. And so what I've done, and you know, I think about conservation and nature and evolution, when evolution develops or nature develops a strategy, it tends to be conserved from simpler organisms to more complex organisms. So when I look, as studying the neuronal synapses and seeing the types of complex interactions of the chemical interactions, the glial interactions with the neurons, all of the complex processes that are involved in neuronal communication, I realize that it's a beautiful model for the synapse between people and the ever-expanding bandwidth of the ways we communicate with other people through eye gaze, through posture, through facial expressions, on and on and on, that give us so much information across the space between us, the social synapse, that allows us to mind read, to have intuitions, to be attuned to each other, to coordinate into social groups so that we're able to function as a group, which is now the mechanism of human survival.
Yeah, you know, we tend to think of our mind as contained in the envelope of our body, but what you're really underscoring is that our nervous system in some ways is socially connected.
Right, right. You know, as is our memory. You know, our memory is a social function, our affect, our emotional regulation is social. And this isn't something that I'm making up because I'm a genius. I mean, I have to credit Murray Bowen and people for the last century who've worked in things like chaos theory and complexity theory that are helping us to understand that we're much bigger than this atomized individual. Of course, you know, Buddhists have known this for thousands of years, as have Hindu philosophers. We're just, again, the whole West is late to this party.
Okay. So one of the things that you talk about is consciousness and self-awareness, both as part of the problem and as a tool for healing or integration. So maybe mm-hmm. you can rhapsodize on that a little bit.
Well, I think, you know, the self-identity, the notion of identity, the notion of self-awareness, these are constructions primarily of the left hemisphere that are approximations of reality, and they're not necessarily designed to reflect reality. They're designed to help us survive. So there are all sorts of inherent distortions built into the way our brains construct our conscious experience of reality that bias our perceptions in a million different ways. And that's really what the 50,000 studies in social psychology have shown us over the last 100 years. And so one of the things that we need to do is to realize that, I guess we need to become intelligent consumers of what our minds offer up to us as reality. Right? We can't accept what our minds offer up to us. We have to develop a methodology of evaluating what our minds believe, so that we can come to more sophisticated choices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the subtitle of your book is Using Our Mind to Change Our Brain. And I think a lot of people kind of equate brain with mind. What's the distinction between mind and brain in your mind?
Right. Or is it in my brain? I don't know. I think the clearest way to put it, the mind emerges from the functioning of the brain. So that I can say, mm-hmm. but the brain is more, when I think of the brain, I think more in terms of the neural wetware, the memories, the habit patterns, the reflexes, the behaviors, the things that go back down into our prehistory. The things we share with everyone and all of our relatives back to turtles and frogs and fish. When I think of mind, I think of this emergent function from the brain that is mostly guided by the brain, but we have the opportunity to see little glimpses of how our brain is functioning so that we can take an almost like a third person perspective on our brains. And maybe you've had this experience. Many times in my life, I've said things, and as they're coming out of my mouth, I'm thinking, that is a really stupid thing to say.
Actually, I've had the reverse when I was teaching, and I would say something that I thought was really great, and it wasn't anything I'd ever thought before. It just kind of came out in the the process. So I guess it can work both ways.
Absolutely, yeah. So there you are, listening to what you're saying and being surprised and impressed by your words.
Yeah, yeah.
So that certainly doesn't mean that, what that means is that your somehow your speech and your thought aren't the same thing. So speech in a way is more of a set of, it's almost like walking or playing tennis. In order to speak as quickly as we do, it's a form of procedural memory that actually seems to have its own drive and its own consciousness. And so if you have the experience of being either ashamed or surprised and impressed by what you're saying, that means that at least we have two consciousnesses, that at least there's two of us in there, right? And maybe they're right and left hemisphere, maybe they're different levels of functioning, who knows? But whatever that is, it's like we've got to be able, and I think this is where the Buddhists really are far ahead of us, because they've been studying this for a couple of thousand years, is that they realize that there's a difference between a self that observes and many other levels of functioning that reacts. And so going back to your question, I think of the brain as the structure of the wetware that houses all of these reflexive patterns. And the mind is the thing every once in a while that sees through it and goes, holy mackerel, look, you know, I'm more than just, you know, my set of habit patterns.
Yeah, yeah. Now, just so that I don't stand out as a total egotist here, surely you've had that experience as a teacher yourself of hearing brilliant things come out of your mouth on occasion.
No, right? David, you've got to own that.
Oh, no.
Okay. Don't try to put that off on me.
Okay, now I'm on the hot seat. I have a tendency to open myself up.
I certainly have had that experience from time to time. And, you know, had you not said it, I would have said it after you. So I'm with you there.
Okay, great. Now, one of the things that we hear a lot about are mirror neurons, and maybe you can tell us a bit about them and how they contribute to therapeutic change.
Mirror neurons are found in the frontal and parietal regions of humans and monkeys. Those are, you know, some monkeys that have been studied so far. What they do is, you know, there's nothing really that special about mirror neurons except that they exist in regions in the executive system. Because our executive brain consists of, you know, frontal and parietal regions that construct space-time. The frontal region is more involved in sequencing and time. I don't know how true that is. They both are. As I'm speaking, there's a part of me listening to what I'm saying, and I'm correcting myself.
Okay.
let me scratch that to say that together, the frontal lobes and the parietal lobes, along with subcortical organs like the cerebellum, the hippocampus, the basal ganglion, our brains construct space-time. And what space-time is the coordination of behavior in three-dimensional space through time. So it's sort of a four-dimensional construction. And that's how, you know, all creatures have existed. The brain adapts to four dimensions. And so our brain constructs this four-dimensional model, which allows us to afford the environment. It allows us to attach to our parents and allows us to use pens and scissors and tools. So what they really are connecting mirror neurons exist at the crossroads of these executive networks that allows us to learn through imitation. So, and this was B.F. Skinner's big dilemma with his trial and error learning theory, because everything was behavioral and taught. He could never explain one trial learning, but had he known about mirror neurons, he would have realized that he could explain one trial learning, because people, as you're watching things, your sensory and motor systems are actually rehearsing them. They're organizing them. And that's what mirror neurons allows to do. And most mirror neurons are focused on the face, on the lips, on the tongue. So originally they were probably designed to help children mirror facial expressions and eat. They'll learn how to eat early on. But what they do in psychotherapy is that they link our experiences. They help us attune across the social synapse so that therapists can create an internal model of their clients and vice versa. And one of the real levers of psychotherapeutic change is the fact that we tend to imitate people that we like, and we don't imitate, we strip that down with people we don't like. And so the reason why the quality of the therapeutic relationship or the quality of the therapist as a person is so important is because what that does is it allows us as therapists to hook up via the mirror neurons with the bodies of our clients, the inner bodies of our clients, and then they start to imitate us. And most therapists have had clients that come back and say, you know, I was about to do this thing, but I heard your voice. Mm-hmm. Or I asked, what would David do if he was in this situation? And so what's happening is that a key method of learning into prehistory has been imitation. And the positive social connection with our clients allows them to imitate who we are, and hopefully if we're sane and we're good therapists, they're internalizing something positive and helpful.
You know, you just gave me a thought, which, you know how some people, when you're speaking to them, their lips will move?
Uh-huh.
Sometimes hypnotists will use that as a way to pick people out who they're going to work with, you know, in mm-hmm. a stage demonstration. Seems to me like maybe mirror neurons are somehow implicated in that phenomenon.
Oh, yeah. I agree. And I think, too, it's like I don't know whether I've always done this. It might have been, you know, like once the mortgage is paid, you think about working differently. But, what I tell clients now is that, you know, if when they call me, I say, well, come on in and let's spend some time together and let's see whether we connect.
Mm-hmm.
And if we connect, then I'm optimistic that I can help.
Yeah.
Because it's something within my, you know, area of expertise.
Yeah. And so how do you know whether you've connected and whether or not that's a mutual thing? Because that seems like a pretty key thing that you've just said.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty much intuitive. I mean, you just get a feel whether you're it's like dancing. Like when you're leading, is someone following correctly or vice versa? Are you talking over each other or are you taking turns? Are your facial expressions linked up? Do you feel excited about working with someone? All of those things, I think, are indications that that the link up across the social synapse has gotten traction and that you've got some leverage to work with someone.
So do you ever have an experience where that doesn't happen? And if so, how do you let them slash yourself off the hook?
Well, I mean, I usually, you know, I try to... You know, I'm going to say lots of different ways. One way is that clients can feel it, and by the end of the session, I'll say, well, let me give you some other names of people that you can meet. I usually do that anyway, even if I feel like connect, because I don't want anyone to feel like I'm trying to, you know, lever them into therapy with
mm-hmm.
me. So there are lots of ways to do it. I try to do it in a way that is non-rejecting and sort of respectful. You know, it's in making the choice of a therapist is important, and I want you to think about this. You know,
yeah.
I think what we have is good, but I want you to be an informed consumer, and I know some really well trained people. Check them out, and I'll be here if you want me.
Yeah, great, great.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of your chapters is fascinatingly titled "The Non-Presenting Problem," and part of the lore of psychodynamic psychotherapy has been that the problem that brings the person into therapy isn't the real problem. Is that what you're getting at, or are you getting at something a bit different?
Well, I think I'm getting at that, but I'm also getting at another thing. In other words, there's this notion of the non-presenting problem where they come in saying one thing, but it's actually another problem that they need to deal with. That's usually the case, right? But also there's a whole other level that that gets ignored often by therapists. I don't think that have the type of in-depth training that they should have. And that is that it may not be a specific problem at all. Very often what's going on, it's a set of defenses or a style of being, more something what Wilhelm Reich would talk about, like a character and character analysis. Because most therapists now aren't trained to work in the transference or understand the character or the characterological aspects. And very often those are the things that are problematic. that create all the problems, be it the presenting problem or the non-presenting problem.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to take it a level or two deeper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, spirituality is a very hot topic these days, and you know, more people are talking about it, and it's kind of sprinkled into lots of conversations and books and so on. You have the courage, in the face of all that, to talk about healthy and unhealthy spirituality,
mm-hmm.
Which seems to me like an important distinction to make. Tell mm-hmm. us about your take on that.
Well, I think, you know, it goes back. This is part of my deep history. I remember as a boy walking with my aunts to church and hearing them gossiping about everyone in the family and and on the way to church, hearing them criticize people of other ethnicities. And, you know, they had nothing good to say. When they got to church, they were very pious. And then walking home after hearing the scripture and taking communion, they went back to being who they were. And so I think it turned me off to religion very early in life. So I started studying spirituality. And, you know, later I ended up doing a master's degree in divinity when I was in my 20s. And again, it was just a search for spirituality and meaning. It wasn't trying to understand a particular religion. But what I noticed when I was in divinity school is I was surrounded by all of these people who were studying to be mostly ministers, some rabbis and some different other denominations. And I realized just how much pain and suffering they experienced and that they were trying to cope with via their spirituality. And I could also see the pathology that they were demonstrating in the name or under the guise of spirituality. And so I think from a very early on, I guess the master's degree in divinity gives me a little confidence that I've got the credentials to talk about this. And so I think I've seen that early on. And one of the things that happens in therapy is we have all this focus on the value of religion or the value of spirituality and all of this mindfulness business that everyone's talking about. But very seldom do you talk about the narcissism and the primitive defenses and those things that get buried underneath the religious rhetoric. And I think all you've got to do is look at the Republican Party for all sorts of examples of how this manifests itself. So I think we really do have to talk about healthy and unhealthy spirituality and what that means and to be able to tell the difference, because I don't think therapists should be respectful of unhealthy spirituality if clients are using it as a defensive structure.
Yeah, I totally agree. Now, you've mm-hmm. got a nifty story at the beginning of one of your chapters in which a friend asks you, what's the difference between a rat and a human being?
Mm-hmm.
So what is the difference anyway?
So the story goes something like this. If you take a rat and you put it in a radial arm maze, which is a maze with a platform in the center and five pathways leading down tunnels, if you put a hungry rat on that center platform, having hidden cheese down the third tunnel, the rat will scurry around and explore the tunnels, and it will find the cheese down the third tunnel and eat the cheese. So if you wait a couple of days and get the rat hungry again and stick it back in the center platform, but you move the cheese to another tunnel, they'll go down the third tunnel and they'll look around. There's no cheese. They'll come out. They'll look around. No cheese. Come out. They'll look around. Go in. No cheese. Come out. Now, the difference between a rat and a human being is that eventually the rat will explore the other tunnels, right? Whereas a human being can go down the third tunnel forever because they come to believe that's where the cheese should be.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Okay.
This goes back to a question that you mentioned before, like what's the difference between our brain and our mind?
Yeah.
The rat doesn't have that much of a mind. And so it's very pragmatic. And if it checks out the third tunnel a few times and the cheese isn't there, it'll start looking around. But the brain of the human is so complex that we'll develop religions and philosophies about the third tunnel. And we'll create demons that will inhabit the other tunnels, the other four tunnels. And we'll go down that third tunnel forever because that's where the cheese should be, damn it.
Okay.
Now
that may relate to another question I was going to ask you about, because somewhere you wrote, your mind is not your friend. You have a whole section
mm-hmm.
on that.
Right.
What? My mind is not my friend? How so?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, to the degree to which your mind is occupied with beliefs and habits and ways of thinking that lead to suffering, right? Then your mind is not your ally. What your mind is doing is continue to justify going down that third tunnel.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So for example, if you had very problematic relationships early in life, if you were abandoned or beaten or neglected, whatever it is, and your mind has developed all sorts of ideas about, and your brain as well, has developed all sorts of ideas and reflexive patterns to intimacy, then whenever you're confronted with something that might be healing to you or that might be positive, you're going to activate old memories and you're going to run away, or you're going to destroy the relationship, or you're going to turn it into where you came from. And so your mind is not your friend when it's justifying habit patterns that are obsolete or anachronistic.
Yeah, yeah. Some people, I'm sure you've heard this saying that psychosis, it's not really accurate psychologically, but that psychosis is doing the same thing and getting the same bad result. Not learning from experience, I guess. I can't remember the exact thing that people say, but something like that.
Yeah, but, you know, it's not, unfortunately, it's not psychosis. You know, what it is just normal neurotic behavior.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and neurotic, I don't mean, you know, neurotic like the Woody Allen version of neurotic. What I mean is that you just keep going down that third tunnel as opposed to taking the risk of exploring the other tunnels and facing your demons.
Yeah. Now, you've mentioned mindfulness and Buddhism a couple of times, and it's a very big topic these days. In fact, I don't know if you saw it, but the current American psychologist has devoted the entire issue to mindfulness. What do you see as the role of mindfulness in psychotherapy?
Well, I'm hoping, I mean, you know, I think now what it is a lot of, superficially, it's a lot of people selling a lot of books, right?
Yeah, right.
That's the superficial part of it. It's a cottage industry. So that's the most superficial. The next layer beneath it is that there's finally a recognition in Western psychology of the importance of self-reflection. You know, after the, you know, we went through psychoanalysis and then we went through all of the behavioral and cognitive rebellion against the value of the inner world. And so now I think perhaps we're swinging back to a moderate position where the, you know, the mind has a lot of distorted problems. It's not the be all and end all. Thought and behavior matter. But, you know, if we can figure out how to tame our minds and figure out how to use them and the shortcomings of our minds, we can, you know, tap into a 3,000 or 4,000-year-old tradition of meditation and self-reflection that can serve us very well in psychotherapy.
Yeah, nicely put. Do you think that, to what extent do you think mindfulness could be a substitute for psychotherapy, or, you know, or might it be a defense against psychotherapy?
Oh, yeah, all of the above.
Yeah.
All of the, you know, in fact, the there's so much, you know, in Los Angeles, there are so many yoga teachers and meditation teachers and this and all the, you're hearing all the time of the narcissistic abuses, just like we found in the ministry and, you know, in the clergy and all of that. Having tools for mindfulness is only as good as the psyche that they're in. And so if someone is disturbed characterologically, they just use the mindfulness to support their defenses and their agenda with other people. And so I don't think that mindfulness can substitute for psychotherapy. I think mindfulness, it's like EMDR. It's a tool of psychotherapy, but it's certainly not a replacement for psychotherapy.
Okay. Talk about the role of the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere in processing information and in the perseverance of old scripts that get in the way of change.
Well, I think, you know, the right hemisphere is probably is the old school. It's the traditional hemisphere. The way the right hemisphere is organized is the way both hemispheres are organized in more primitive animals. In other words, it's dominated by fight-flight reactions, so fear, high states of emotion, fear, and low states of emotion, withdrawal, like playing dead. So so sympathetic and parasympathetic dominance. The left hemisphere is more of an experiment that goes along with the evolution of sociality and humans becoming a fundamentally social species. Okay, so the left hemisphere greases the social wheels. It connects with others through right-handed handshakes and all of that. And so what you've got, we have a right hemisphere that's very primitive and has an early critical period during the first year and a half or so of life. And that's when the unconscious of our parents gets downloaded and the infrastructure of our intrapsychic worlds become organized, downloaded from the intrapsychic world of our parents, downloaded from the intrapsychic world of their parents. So there's this sort of this invisible transmission across the generations of the way the world is seen and experienced and all of that. And so that is the core. That's why what happens during the first few years will be with us when we're 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years old, because that infrastructure is built very early on unconsciously. We never remember learning it, right? And then later, as we develop, the left hemisphere develops and they go back and forth. The data that we have is up until about 13 years old, but the critical periods or the sensitive periods go back and forth between the hemispheres. So we have these two fundamental brains in our skull that are programmed in different ways, and the left hemisphere sort of is in charge during the day, at least outwardly, with a lot of influence from the right, and the right hemisphere is in charge when we're sleeping. Okay? A gross oversimplification, but that's sort of the general thing. So a lot of us, for example, a lot of us know what we should do. We should eat right. We should, we shouldn't cheat on our husbands and wives. It's like all these things we should do, and yet we do the stuff anyway. You know, we still eat the pepperoni pizza. Why? Well, because we're driven in a primitive way to do these things, and our left hemisphere doesn't have the leverage of inhibition to keep us from doing it. And so I think very often in psychotherapy, people come in. I mean, people have watched Oprah for years now. They know what they're supposed to do, right?
Yeah.
But they can't do it. And the reason
Oprah
why
can't do it.
The reason they can't do it, I'm sure the reason why Oprah's weight goes up and down is because of her right hemisphere. She knows better, and she's got all the money in the world to have people, you know, dietitians and trainers and all of this stuff, but there are more powerful forces than conscious awareness, and that's really these primitive programmings of the right hemisphere that were downloaded from our parents and our grandparents. And that's the reason why I think it's so important for us when we're working with clients to understand them going back 2, 3, 4 generations. We have to understand their culture, their histories, the trauma. I have many clients that their behavior doesn't make any sense given their lives, but it makes lots of sense given their parents and their grandparents. So some of us live out the lives or live out the trauma of our grandparents, you know? And
yeah.
So these are the things that we've got to get smarter as therapists. Instead of becoming devotees of one charismatic leader or cult leader, we have to be smarter and become more scientific in our approach to clients.
Well, the way that you've laid out the function of left and right hemispheres is a lot of new learning for me there. I really appreciate that. I think my brain has been stuck in the 70s where there was a very different description and nothing at all that really related to therapy. So that's really a great new addition, I think, that you've shared with us.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us, since we're doing that sort of thing, maybe you can tell us a bit about the amygdala versus the hippocampus in the way that memory is handled.
Mm-hmm. Well, the amygdala is listeners that don't know that much about these structures. These are both subcortical structures in the limbic system. There are two of them. There's one on each side of the brain. And so both the hippocampi and the amygdala are, or amygdalae, I guess is plural, although no one uses that. They're on each side of the brain and they're lateralized to the degree to which they sort of subserve that hemisphere. Okay. And so for example, the right amygdala is more involved, say, with social emotional functioning and attachment, whereas the left amygdala is more involved with appraisal of semantic information and external social information. The hippocampus and the amygdala differ. The amygdala is more primitive. It's our primitive executive structure, And so before we had prefrontal cortex, we, species of mammals and reptiles had amygdalas that were making decisions, approach avoidance decisions. So one way to think about the prefrontal cortex is just a later elaboration on an amygdala that's capable of making more elaborate or finely tuned decisions about approach and avoidance. The amygdala has a more primitive structure. It's programmed that it exhibits what's called persistent dendritic modeling. And that's a technical term for the fact that if something scares you or terrifies you, the amygdala doesn't forget. It's sort of like the elephant in our brain. And so when we're terrified or traumatized by something, the amygdala is programmed to not let go of that memory. And so if you're having successful treatment with someone who has PTSD or some other thing related to phobia, what you're not getting rid of the memory, it's currently believed. What you're doing is you're building descending circuitry from the cortex to inhibit the output of the amygdala to the brainstem so that we don't have the panic symptoms or the arousal symptoms. So curing someone of phobia isn't getting them to forget the phobia. They're remembering it, but you're building the necessary descending inhibition to keep the amygdala from activating the sympathetic nervous system.
Now, where does the hippocampus fit into that paradigm?
Well, the hippocampus is a later evolving structure. With animals, the hippocampus was a place map. So, for example, rats have very elaborate hippocampi because they're involved in, they forage for food and hide it, and then they have to find it again. And in fact, if you give a young female rat, a little baby pup to take care of, their hippocampus immediately starts to grow because the smell and the interaction with the pup triggers their brain to get ready to have to gather and find and hide more food for their pup. Okay. And it isn't even mediated hormonally because it can be a virgin rat that you're giving a pup to. So the hippocampus is designed to learn and relearn and relearn because the food keeps changing places. Okay, so it's opposite. It doesn't have that persistent dendritic modeling like the amygdala does. It's designed to learn something. You learn a map, and then when that food is gone, you learn another map.
Mm-hmm.
And the bigger the environment that you have to, you have to traverse, the larger your hippocampus will become. And in fact, there's wonderful research that shows that London cab drivers and New York cab drivers have much larger hippocampi.
Wow, yeah. That's great. Mm-hmm. I can't believe the level at which we've been able to get, I say we, not me, but that some people have been able to get down to in terms of studying the brain. And these structures are so small, they're so tiny, it's hard mm-hmm. to believe that they could contain so much information. But I guess they're networked out to other parts of the brain so that, in fact, there are lots and lots of neurons involved.
Yeah, well, think in terms of, now you can wear a computer on your wrist.
I have one right now.
There you go. And so you think about the computing power of, that technology is starting to accomplish. And evolution's been working on this for a few million years.
Yeah.
And they've got it down. We've got, these billions or trillions of connections. And that's really what information processing is about. It's just the number of on and off switches throughout the brain in very complex patterns.
Okay, we talked about social synapse earlier, and then later in the book you have a whole section, I think, devoted to the social brain. So how does the social brain figure into some of the disorders that you discuss, such as a failure to thrive, depression, self-harm?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, when you begin to think of the brain as a social organ, psychopathology starts to realign itself, in a way around the attachment history. And so when you think in terms, and you also think in terms of that the brain's primary environment, now human brain's primary environment is social relationships. And so the nature of attachment doesn't only make you secure or insecure, it also is the primary stimulus of brain growth. And so the effects of, the effects of deprivation, the effects of institutionalization, parental loss, all of these things have a profound effect, not just on someone's psychology, but on the very structures, you know, the neuroanatomy and the biochemistry of their brains, right? We tend to think of attachment schema, for example, as a, it's almost like a cognitive, we get a cognitive notion of it when you think in terms of the, using the word schema. But there, you know, the internalized mother or parent is not just a picture of your mother at the stove stirring sauce like it is for most Italian boys, right? What it is the number of endorphin receptors in your amygdala, of cortisol receptors in your hippocampus, of the hierarchical networks between your prefrontal cortex and your amygdala and your brainstem, the construction of von Eckermo neurons that connect the different levels of our basal forebrain that allow us to have complex communication across different levels of our, you know, our neuraxis. And so the internalized mother goes very deep, down to the very, to our abilities to love and work, to learn, to regulate emotion and all of that. So the brain, we need to, in order to understand the brain at a higher level, we need to understand that brains, you can study your brain under in a scanner, but when you separate it from relationships, you're not getting the real picture of what it is and what it does. Social neuroscience, you know, can create these little ball toss games, which I think is wonderful. You know, with Naomi Eisenberger has done at UCLA, they've got the ball toss game going back and forth into the person, and then the person gets excluded, and their pain circuitry becomes activated when they're excluded from the ball toss game in this computer as they're lying underneath the scanner. And they also found later that if you give someone Tylenol, the effect of the social rejection isn't as bad. So this shows that our social behavior is grounded in the evolution of our physical experience. So that makes sense. It's another strike in the direction of evidence for evolution, right? But all of these things help us to understand just a bit of what goes on in social relationships, but it's not the same as studying us in social relationships. Social psychology really has the edge and the history in that department.
Yeah, to me, this is the most fascinating and exciting aspect of this emerging neuroscience, the way that it's been possible to correlate and anchor attachment theory, which in some form or another probably goes all the way back to Freud, and then it got elaborated by others as time went on, but but now to understand it in terms of neuroscience, I think it's just very exciting.
Oh yeah, it's wonderful to just get it at that other level, and I think we have yet to really understand attachment theory in the context of social groups. That I think is the next challenge. You know, I wanted to say too, something that's in this book, Why Therapy Works, is a couple of chapters that are forming the core of my next book, which has to do with a social status schema. So I always thought, you know, I've been working with CEOs and executives in the last few years, and so I've become very interested in alpha and beta behavior in social groups and in decision-making and leadership and all. Uh-huh. And I guess I always naively assumed that people's social behavior in groups was sort of dependent on their attachment schema. But what I got to see over the last few years when I was looking closely is that there are people that are all kinds of different, you know, like secure alphas, insecure alphas, secure betas, insecure betas, aspirational betas. There are all sorts of different manifestations in social status schema that are orthogonal or unrelated to attachment schema. And so then I began to see that they're just like we have these implicit memories that we call attachment schema. We also very early on develop social status schema, which get activated not in intimate relationships, but that get activated in group situations that lead us to either go to the front of the group or to be in the middle of the group or stay in the back of the room, right? And in the animal kingdom, a lot of these things, just like attachment schema, are inherited from your parents. And most of us inherit social status schema as well from our parents, probably both biochemically and also through modeling. And so this is the next thing I'm working on. In other words, and I think therapists largely ignore this because therapy exists outside of the world. But when you're in a corporate situation, you see that someone's, you know, if someone is programmed biologically to be a beta, but they're trying to be an alpha, all of the different aspects, for example, of shame that come up. And the shame isn't about who they are. Their shame, I mean, it isn't about their behavior. Their shame is about who they are as a person. And I've come to believe that this core shame, you know, the shame that doesn't relate to our behavior, but is feels like it's about us, that that's not a function or a mechanism of individual psychology as much as a mechanism of social organization.
I'm going to look forward to interviewing you about that book when it comes out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the thing that I'm working on now, and I'm, you know, I'm benefiting from the work that I've done in attachment and in the neuroscience, but it really is somewhat new territory for me, and I'm, you know, I'm looking at sort of aspects of leadership. I'm really interested in these, all of these strategies now that are emerging for how to pick up women, because I think within the context of these pickup artists, that there's the thing called the game and other things, and embedded in these sort of pickup strategies are these primitive social status manifestations that are being utilized in a somewhat distasteful way to form relationships.
Wow. That's an interesting leap. That's an interesting leap, but it does make sense as you describe it. And I hope that your research and your book will help us to understand why meetings are often so dreadful.
Oh, aren't they terrible?
Yeah, they're terrible. And, you know, I was in a psychology department for 35 years, and all the individuals in there were fine, noble people. Mm-hmm. But our meetings, we struggled and struggled. The meetings were just, people hated to go to the department meetings.
Yeah, they make me lose the will to live.
So you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, very well.
Yeah.
Very well. I figured out I got so disruptive at those meetings that when I don't show up, people are happy. So that works out for me.
Yeah, it worked. That's a win-win, huh?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Uh-huh. Well, we've covered a lot of your book, but we also want to leave out enough to motivate people to buy it. So
they no longer need it now. They got it.
No, they didn't. They got a bunch of it, but believe me, there's a lot more meat in there. So I'll just ask you about one more topic. Unfortunately, it's a huge topic, and that's trauma. Mm-hmm. What should we know about trauma and why psychotherapy can help from a neurological perspective?
Well, I think there's been a lot of trial and error over the last 130 years, at least. I'm dating it back to Freud's neurology residency at the Salpêtrière when he was working with Charcot. The foundation of psychoanalysis was working with people who primarily had industrial accidents, and the neurological manifestations of those things that didn't have any neurological foundation. I think that we still have a way to go in understanding how the brain functions and what happens in trauma, but we've got many of the important pieces. It's important, like as we said before, we have to understand that the amygdala was the primitive executive system, and it retains veto power over the cortex in times of overwhelming stress. Just like the right hemisphere succeeds or bows to the left hemisphere, except in states of really high arousal. And so what trauma does is it activates the primitive parts of our brain, puts them in control, and it makes it very difficult for us to re-regulate our brains to live in modern society and regulate affect, in a way that is helpful. So there are some new things. In other words, one of the things that I've come across in recent years was, I believed in one of my teachers, Bessel van der Kolk, was very supportive of the EMDR, and I was always skeptical until eventually I took the training, and I realized, holy mackerel, this stuff works. But then I had, how does it work, was the question.
Yeah.
And so what the neuroscience shows us is that when you're traumatized, your neural coherence changes to the point where, for example, for people that don't have PTSD, when we run into some new experience, there are certain areas of the frontal lobes that become activated, for example, like the interior cingulate, which is near the frontal lobes, detects the anomaly, activates attentional mechanisms, and we're alerted that we're going to have some new input coming in, and our hippocampus wakes up. For people with PTSD, one of the changes in neurocoherence is that when something new arises, the anomaly detectors don't get activated, but autobiographical memory becomes detected. So for people with PTSD, everywhere they go, if they run into something new, they've already been there and it's bad. And so you have this symptom in PTSD called neophobia, which is the fear of anything new, which arises from the shift in neural coherence. So the way I would imagine EMDR works is that you're activating the orienting system through the eye movement or the bodily touches or whatever they do, the physical manifestations of EMDR therapy. You're activating the orienting system in a way that allows the brain to override that reflex to go to autobiographical memory. So what's happening in EMDR is that your neural coherence is changing to the point where you can process and update old information. And I think that's how it works.
Okay.
Yeah.
Boy, you got a lot out there. One of the things I was going to ask you was if there is a particular approach to working with trauma that you think is most effective. Would it be EMDR? There are a number of them out there now that pretty much target trauma.
Yeah, I mean, I always think about the large toolboxes, the chrome toolboxes they sell at Sears,
yeah.
The kind that most people envy. Like your whole life, you say, when I grew up, I'm going to get one of those giant toolboxes. I think about that. That's the type of toolbox that you need if you're working with trauma. You need to explore and study all forms of intervention. And as we understand more about what happens to the brain, we'll know when to open which drawer and use which tool.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do EMDR training, you're not a trauma therapist. You're somebody who's got a tool. Right? Just
okay.
Like if you buy a wrench, it doesn't mean you're a mechanic.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, I think that, there are somatic therapies, there are, all kinds of different treatments, systematic desensitization. The skill is, A, creating the relationship with the client that makes them feel safe, and B, selecting the type of intervention, and C, being able to implement it or bring in other people to work with you.
Yeah.
So, Bessel van der Kolk has a new version of his old book, The Body Keeps the Score, or something like that, whatever that his new book is, that's the old book. He really has the right approach. It's whatever works, and the therapist has to figure out what that is that works.
Yeah, I think I interviewed him about that book, and
yeah.
I'm blocking on the title as well, but I remember that he talked about EMDR.
Yeah, it's I think it's The Body Keeps the Score, because
yes.
I like to plug this book. I think it's wonderful.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you studied with him?
No, I haven't studied. I've studied his work my whole career.
See.
And he's been, I think, for me, the major voice of reason within a very dysfunctional, sort of trauma therapy world.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's sort of the buoy in the middle of the ocean.
Okay, yeah, well, I was very impressed
by
him as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as we wind down, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Let me think. Yeah, I think, going back just to tie what we're talking about to the notion of the social brain, is I think that we have to stop thinking of the brain as this organ in a body like a pancreas or a liver. The brain is really, and I love Dan Siegel's definition, it's a hub of energy and information. And the hub thing is really important because what it does is it links us to other brains. So as a social brain, we're a part of a whole, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's the way we have to study brains, going back to Murray Bowen and the systems therapist from 50 years ago. We have to see the brain in that way because we exist in relationships even when we're sitting alone in a cave on a mountaintop, that all of the people that we've been in relationship live inside of us. And like in AA, they say you can make a geographical intervention, but everywhere you go, there you are.
Right.
You can't get away from yourself and all the people that have been inside of you.
Yeah. Okay, well, you've given us a lot to think about. So, Dr. Lou Cozzolino, I want to thank you for being my guest again today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're welcome, David. My pleasure.
Well, today's interview is a perfect follow-on to last week's interview with Dr. Gary Trosclair, which was on how to get the most out of psychotherapy. So we've got getting the most out of psychotherapy and then a detailed neuroscience explanation of what makes that therapy work. And, as with last week's book, Dr. Cozzolino does a remarkable job of tackling what is a potentially mind-boggling subject, replete with lots of scientific detail, and making it extremely straightforward and readable. Really, this is a book that I think just about any layperson could pick up and read, and in the process, they would painlessly digest a lot of great information from the frontiers of neuroscience. This is a great book, not only for potential clients and students, but also for therapists and other professionals. As you know, I've read a lot of the new neuroscience and interviewed a number of leading authors on this subject, but as you heard, I learned a lot about the functions of the right and left hemispheres that I had not previously encountered. So I recommend this book highly. I don't know how Dr. Cozzolino keeps all that information in his head, but he clearly works very hard at keeping up with the latest and then putting it into terms that anyone can understand. The title of Dr. Louis Cozzolino's book, again, is Why Therapy Works, Using Our Minds to Change Our Brains. And, as always, if you'll use our Amazon.com affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar of our site, you'll also be helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Cindy Gozanski from Portland, Maine. I am a master's level psychotherapist, and I have chosen to support Shrink Wrap Radio financially because of the immense benefit that I get from your podcast. I am in private practice and an adjunct instructor for our graduate counseling program at University of Southern Maine, and find that your Shrink Wrap Radio guests and information is so helpful to me in both of these fields. Often, after I hear one of your guests, I purchase the book or go to their website and I'm able to really incorporate more of the amazing information, techniques, tips, and other things that are so useful that you provide. Again, I am so grateful for the wonderful features that Shrink Wrap Radio provides to all of the listeners, and especially the professional listeners like myself in the area. And I have shared Shrink Wrap Radio and will continue to do so with many of my students and colleagues. Once again, thank you so much, Dr. Dave, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Cindy. It's wonderful to receive such strong support from a fellow professional there in Maine. Thanks both for your support and for helping to spread the word among your students and others. I also want to say thanks to all of you out there who've been supporting Shrink Wrap Radio. My heart is filled with gratitude every time I go into PayPal and see the names of my ongoing and new donors. Thank you all so much. Your faith and steadfastness are what keeps me going. We do have one new donor on our honor roll, and that's Fiona Donahoe Bales. Thank you, Fiona. And as I've mentioned in the past, Dr. Hedaya of Holistic Psychiatry has an herbal pain relief product called Unflame. I've been advertising it in our right-hand sidebar. Dr. Hedaya recently emailed me another testimonial. He wrote that another guy called and was on the verge of a double knee replacement, which has been now avoided. And he goes on to say, while I'm not making any money yet, I am helping people, and you are helping me to help these people. It's a very worthy endeavor, he says. Now you can get $5 off by using my discount code of UNFL1815, when you call direct at 619-500-4372. Once again, if you haven't already done so, Let me remind you to go to the survey tab on our site to take the updated survey. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, I have yet another great recommendation today. Over this past weekend, I went to the movies with one of my sons and saw the documentary He Named Me Malala, about the young Pakistani girl who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2014. It's an incredibly inspiring film about courage and resilience. I recommend you see it if at all possible. Alternatively, Audible.com has a recorded version of her autobiographical book. It's titled I Am Malala, The Girl Who Stood Up for Education and Was Shot by the Taliban. And that's by Malala Yousafzai herself, and is narrated by Archie Punjabi. Now, if any of you are fans of the television series The Good Wife, then you will know Archie Punjabi as Kalinda. So that's added reason to go for this one. And if you do, you'll get 9 hours and 55 minutes. That's almost 10 hours of very inspiring educational material and very psychological as well, right? So let me play you a little sample, as I've been doing of late.
As Khushal's school started to attract more pupils, we moved again and finally had a television. My favorite program was Shaka Laka Boom Boom, an Indian children's series about a boy called Sanju who has a magic pencil. Everything he drew became real. If he drew a vegetable or a policeman, the vegetable or policeman would magically appear. If he accidentally drew a snake, he could erase it and the snake would disappear. He used his pencil to help people. He even saved his parents from gangsters. And I wanted that magic pencil more than anything in the world. At night, I would pray, God, give me Sanju's pencil. I won't tell anyone. Just leave it in my cupboard. I will use it to make everyone happy. As soon as I finished praying, I would check the drawer. The pencil was never there, but I knew who I would help first. Just along the street from our new house was an abandoned strip of land that people used as a rubbish dump. There is no rubbish collection in Swat. Quickly, it became a rubbish mountain. I didn't like walking near it as it smelled so bad. Sometimes we would spot black rats running through it and crows would circle overhead. One day, my brothers were not home and my mother had asked me to throw away some potato peel and eggshells. I wrinkled my nose as I approached, swatting away flies and making sure I didn't step on anything in my nice shoes. As I threw the rubbish on the mountain of rotting food, I saw something move and I jumped. It was a girl about my age. Her hair was matted and her skin was covered in sores. She looked like I imagined Shashaka, the dirty woman they told us about in tales in the village to make us wash. The girl had a big sack and was sorting rubbish into piles, one for cans, one for bottle tops, another for glass and another for paper. Nearby, there were boys fishing in the pile for metal using magnets on strings. I wanted to talk to the children, but I was too scared. That afternoon when my father came home from school, I told him about the scavenger children and begged him to go with me to look. He tried to talk to them, but they ran away. He explained that the children would sell what they had sorted to a garbage shop for a few rupees.
Now, I know the volume on that was a little lower than the rest of this episode, but I hope you were able to make it out. If you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep, and with no obligation to continue your subscription, by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that one isn't the one that you want to get, they've got more than 180,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is Marnie Feuerman, licensed clinical social worker and marriage and family therapist, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Marnie, who in fact will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. I think I will skip the reading of listener emails today. So with that, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use our app for that. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Lou Cozzolino, for his insights into how therapy works. My next guest will be Marnie Feuerman, licensed professional counselor who specializes in working with couples. And we'll be discussing the sorts of things that go wrong these days in couples' relationships and how she works with them. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.